The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined by John Mulville, who is digitalization lead at Siemens, Paul Williams, crime journalist with the Irish Independent, and Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Before we get into matters more important, Scott, as a political analyst from the Clinton Institute, how realistic was the West Wing, out of curiosity? Were you a fan?
I was a fan, while at the same time realizing that it was the Hollywood treatment on what liberals would want a president to be like, and trying to match up the reality between Josiah Bartlett and Bill Clinton, who had his own spectacle around him. That was a challenge each and every week. But I think at the end of the day, if we could have Josiah Bartlett back in 2024, yeah, I'd be okay with that.
Well, we'll find if Robert Schiff agrees with you after 11 o'clock. Before that, we move to the news of the day. There's a lot of discussion around the hate speech bill, because Helen McEntee has now confirmed the story that was in the Times yesterday. You would have heard us speaking to Jack Horgan-Jones about it, which was that the pieces of the legislation in respect of hate speech that she and Simon Harris, when he was in her stead during maternity leave, had both been fostering through the various different stages of Dáil and committees and Senate, they have been removed from the proposed bill on the grounds, as Helen McEntee says, that there wasn't consensus. Meanwhile, there is, according to the Mail, significant concerns about the continued rise of the far right and what we might see as we move into an election. Paul Williams, first of all, to the first half of that, the killing of the hate speech chunk of that bill. Were you surprised that it was quietly snuck out?
To tell you the truth, I've been writing a book for the past few months, and the hate speech legislation was the last thing on my agenda. But I was watching closely the opposition to it. And I think that from what I picked up from it was that there was a fear that it was going to be too much of a blunt instrument, that it was going to drag in, you know, you could accuse anybody of hate speech. And I think that was one of the concerns some of the politicians made. But clearly, McEntee, she overstepped herself on this and didn't do her homework, because she doesn't have the support for it. So it has been, as one of the headlines here in the Mail says, you know, it was a humiliation for her, I would say, think.
And it's interesting that her predecessor in that role, and her Fine Gael predecessor in that role, Alan Shatter, former Justice Minister,
furious about it,
seething. He has on Twitter said, I'll cut it down because it is fairly significant, but he said, major tactical policing and resource failures by Garda management facilitated the mayhem at the Crown Paints site designed for asylum seekers. It seems now that the Minister for Justice and the government are intent on surrendering our streets, roads and private property to occupation by thugs and abandoning civilians and Gardaí to racist targeting and intimidation. It is indefensible political cowardice and electoral opportunism utterly lacking in a moral compass. The fact that badly needed new proposed legislation has generated controversy does not justify its abandonment on the eve of a general election. He's hardly holding back, Scott Lucas, is he?
Well, he's got a bit of skin in the game, because Alan Shatter is very concerned because of his position on Israel about, and he's very forthright about that. And so do people like Elon Musk, who will be cited. He's got skin in the game as well.
And Elon Musk, of course, was critical of our proposed legislation when it was proposed.
He was proposing funding anybody in Ireland who wanted to take a case against the Irish government if they put it through. Elon Musk is all in as an absolute liberal on all speech is absolutely allowable. And the cesspool that is X Twitter right now is absolute evidence of that. I mean, he went in there going, oh yeah, I'm going to clean up Twitter, and going, worse it's gotten. It is just the most
vile. Reminds me of one of those characters you get in one of the Bond movies, you know, this mad billionaire. Who the hell is he to be telling people what to think and not to think? I agree with you totally. I think he's a very coercive or corrosive influence on
the, well, let us come back slightly from just to that one thing that he focused on, which was the hate speech, because Scott, yeah, you're continuing.
It's a great example, because I think what you have to do is distinguish between the folks who are creating dumpster fires like Elon Musk and J.D. Vance, now vice presidential candidate for the U.S., who weighed in on this trying to get political points, and the real issues around the bill as it was crafted.
And I think what?
I think the real issue around it as crafted is that the definition of hate was left too abstract in the bill. What constitutes, let's say you go on to X or Insta or TikTok, what constitutes hate? And personally, I think what you have to do with hate speech is tie it to what the crime is that may ensue. So speech that incites violence, I think you can prosecute that, but you have to make that clear in the legislation.
Difficult prosecution, of course. Challenging prosecution. It's like the thing of bribery. You have to connect the payment to an actual delivery.
It is. But as we are seeing, for example, with the January 6th trials in the United States, that is an example where, in part, hate speech played a part in the Capitol riots. When you talk about the UK's riots at the end of July, if you had carefully crafted legislation about the disinformation that spurred those riots, then I think you've got grounds to proceed. This bill was too abstract in terms of not setting out what the specific criminal activity is that could be prosecuted.
Well, what about the other half of it then? Because, Paul, this is in your bailiwick. The rise of the far right, the riots that we saw in Coolock, the allegations, again, going back to what Alan Chatter is saying, that that is a failure of policing. And I think Drew Harris himself said that there were questions to be answered in respect of the removal of the public order unit from that area on the Malahide Road.
It was
just turn that mic sideways.
Watching,
if you were following,
watching that program on TV the other night, or primetime special, was frightening. And I tell you what was terrifying about it was the fact that people were being surrounded by these barbarians, literally at the gate, using the most vile language, and also like it was pure white hatred. It was on the edge of murder, because if they physically got their hands on some of these people, and they're on the phone ringing the guards, and nothing's coming. And by the way, this is another issue. This is a symptom of a bigger problem. We're going to get a lot more of that. I remember about 15, 20 years ago, a young fellow went into Temple Moor, and what they were teaching them at the time, would you believe, and this was a harbinger of what was to come, that in time to come, we're going to be in a situation where we get a 999 call and we're going to have to assuage the person on the other side of the phone that we're not going to get to them when they want us to get there. This was a long time ago. The fact that the police then, this over-politically correct nonsense from Drew Harris, the police are there for a reason. They're there to restore order. They're the only agency in the state allowed to use physical coercive force, because that's what they're there for. They sent in uniform guards to get battered around the place. They held back the public order unit. Like, all they're worried about is optics, when the thing is that it was very, very clear that these people, no matter who they were, like anybody in any situation, you're picking up the phone. It was one of those scary, scary moments that we're now in a situation in this little republic of ours, this fabulous little country of ours, where you pick up the phone and you ask for help and the help isn't coming. And that is going to
now,
become
a
phenomenon,
a
I think.
Of policing policy, or is that there is a fear among individual sworn members that what you get is that GSOC will come down you like a ton of bricks if you are seen to have acted inappropriately, or that there are lawsuits, or that you are punished for stepping across what is now acceptable policing?
You've opened up a whole can of worms there. The lower ranks, for example, the GRA made a statement this week, and I read it yesterday, and it made great, great sense, because they said, look, if any of our members did something, attacked somebody or got into a row, you know, and were a bit more robust than they should have been, or as robust as they should have been, then they will be facing disciplinary action. Yet, the senior management who put their members at risk and left them there to be beaten and battered with no support, no public order unit, they answer no questions. And Drew Harris coming out and apologising, saying, oh, well, you know, we think we got it wrong. Bloody right he got it wrong. We need, going back to the bigger picture here, this started with that protest last year, was it, outside the Dáil, where Michael Healy-Ray was being attacked by a bunch of thugs. And, you know, that, from the minute that starts, you just show zero tolerance. As I said to Pat Kenny here one morning, a smack of a baton when it's entitled, and when you're entitled to it, give it to them. Because if what has happened here is that they take this mob, and like the criminals themselves and the antisocial mobs, are taking complete advantage of a disorganised and demoralised police force, and that is bad for democracy and everybody.
Joan, do you believe then that the prediction in the Mail is correct? Because what the Mail is saying is main parties fear far-right no-go zones as threat of violence grows. In other words, that people who are canvassing in the election, whether it be in November, whether it be in February, will find themselves in a position where there are chunks of constituencies that they cannot go into for fear of mobs.
I do actually think that is a reality right now. I mean, I think to be a general election candidate at the moment is a scary, it's a scary prospect. It is. I think it's really, really challenging, really difficult. I think I look at the number of people who are leaving politics. I look at the challenges that we have in attracting people into politics now. And you think about everything we've just talked about hate speech, whether that's online or in person. And then you think about the peril, literally, of having to canvass certain areas and actually recognising in some parts that you cannot go there. And then the knock-on effect of that is that if you cannot have good people, good politicians, engaging in discourse with people in areas that are so affected by some of these challenges, and a lot of it is social deprivation, and they somehow think that immigrants are the reason they are socially deprived, you know, that creates longer term problems as well. It makes the whole situation worse. It exacerbates it. And I think we do have a real challenge now. If I was a young candidate considering going into politics, I would be really, really nervous about certain areas, obviously far worse than others. But I do think that it's, as I say, it is a problem now, but I think it's going to create a bigger long-term problem because we won't have engagement with people who desperately need that kind of engagement.
Scott, you want to go in?
I think all these points are valid, but I've got a problem with the way it's presented in the Mail on Sunday because I think it magnifies the problem. There's not a single quote in the story that actually refers to a no-go zone. That's in the headline. What it talks about is that candidates are worried about intimidation. They are worried about threats of violence that come and that those could be increasing, especially from the far right. And that's an absolutely legitimate fear. But the way that the Mail portrays it in the headline, that there's entire sections of communities where you cannot walk, it's a mirror image of what was said about the UK by the far right.
I would say, though, there will be parts of Coolock. There will be parts I can think of when looking at the faces of some of these gentle people who are going to for election, that the places where they're being elected, I would not like to be a member of Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael or even Sinn Féin, because they're taking Sinn Féin apart. Yeah. Sinn Féin are taking the brunt of the blame for all of this. And that level, I think the big problem here is this, Scott. When you allow this behaviour to take any kind of hold, like in Germany or in France, you act a maggot like that on the street, the police will come along and they will show you why they have the powers of coercion. Yeah. You know, and they like, and I think,
Although in both countries, we see the far right gaining great political traction, even if it's not through violence.
But when they come out to play, like they did here in Coolock, they're not tolerated.
Yeah.
And they get the full brunt of the force.
To mention the far right in terms of making political strides, and there is an interesting piece in that article which identifies, I think it's rather ironic, the three parties that are running candidates, the Ireland First, the Irish People and the National Party. I mean, they are literally a living example of the division that they're trying to seed everywhere else. They are completely divided. They're literally fighting over these particular areas where they can get a foothold. They're going to split their own vote. Thanks be to goodness. I'm not even going to mention their candidates. I wouldn't want to give them the airtime, frankly. But I do think that is really interesting in itself. They haven't got... We talked about hate speech. There's so much hatred generally. People are so angry, and they're angry with everybody. They're angry with themselves. They're angry with...
Are they, or is this astroturfing? Is there a real general anger out there, or is there an online fomented... Mm-hmm.
I mean specifically within these three parties, as in this small, and I still think in Ireland, still relatively small cohort of people are being fired up, but they can't, and they all, in theory, they think that they all are all about this whole Ireland First thingy and that they're the only ones who are interested in us as a country and they've got your back. But there's still three of them and they can't agree on anything.
They
are divisive in themselves. They're
Scott
showing
has been
their
inhaling a lot over here. Go on, Scott.
I think these points are valid. And the reason why I made the statement I did, Paul, is because coming out of the UK and then also watching happening in the United States, and as a recent blow-in here, there are issues that need to be addressed about police. There's issues that need to be addressed about housing. There's issues that need to be addressed about infrastructure. But Coolock, for me, is a nasty exception which should not become the rule. And I think part of that not becoming the rule has to be the idea that we don't reinforce the idea of no-go zones.
Scott, when you look again at the piece, if I refer back to the Mail, one thing that Debbie McCann has done is a breakdown of all of the various different arson attacks where we haven't seen prosecutions. It's a long list. Bunkrana, Sandwith, Ballincollig, Ballybrack, Finglas, Brittis, Leixlip, Coolock.
And you have a minority of folks out there, a small minority, who hope through those arson attacks not only to cause damage, but to take the oxygen out of the room where you talk only about them and about their grievances. And the idea of is, how do you respond in terms of going high when they go low? Which is, we've got to address policing, we've got to address housing, and we've got to address a decent and tolerant immigration policy in terms of maintaining this civic community in Ireland, which is in much better health with all the issues that are there than it is in the UK right now.
We do need to look at, across the water. We'll go in the other direction because a lot of US politics are interesting at the moment. Before that, I want to give you just a quick shot at the cash machine. The cash machine is a big one, €200,000, and it's going to be a guaranteed €200,000. Taking part is easy. We give you an amount, you take a note of it, you enter, and if we call you and you give us the right number, you win the money. If you have entered since Victor won, he was our last winner on the 13th, you're still in to win, but you must know the new amount, and the new amount is €200,000 exactly. You can text the word play to 57557. That's 57557. Cost is €2.50 plus your standard message rate to play. You have to be over 18. You're playing across the Goaled network of stations. And if you fancy reading terms and conditions, you can get them on newstalk.com. So get your entry in by 3 p.m. on Friday. Cash machine then picks one person at random. If you answer and it's you within five rings, tell us the prize amount. You walk away with the money. The money and the prize amount, €200,000. Exactly. Now, coming up after the break, we'll be discussing whether or not working from home is on its last legs, because a lot of analysis in the paper suggests that it is. And we'll also be discussing how Mohamed Al-Fayed managed to dodge all of the allegations and accusations that have been made against him post-mortem while he was still alive. Stay with us. It is the Anton Savage Show. I'm joined by Paul Williams, crime journalist with the Irish Independent, Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute in UCD, and John Mulvihill, digitalization lead at Siemens, and an artist, I should say as well. Text to say, discussion in relation to the far right. We've just returned from a week's holiday in Rome. What's so striking about Rome is we could walk the length and breadth of the streets, and round every corner in the centre of the city, there are loads of armed police and armed soldiers. We did not see one drug dealer or observe any street violence. Can we not take a note out of their book? After all, Italy is also in the EU. 53106 at a cost of 30 cents or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp. Lot of analysis about Mohamed Al-Fayed and the allegations and accusations that have emerged about him. If you missed it yesterday, by the way, you can it's up on podcast, our discussion with the lawyer representing a lot of the women who are seeking retribution and compensation from Harrods after what they say was done to them by Mohamed Al-Fayed. The litany of abuse that he seems to allegedly have taken part in is fairly stark and harrowing, Joan, isn't it?
It seems to be everywhere. You were safe nowhere. In the air, on an airplane, in a hotel, in a football team, in a football club. I mean,
this is the warning. Fulham warned the women's team to stay away from them.
Yeah, young blonde girls. I mean, there was one shocking line, and I suppose, as the woman on the panel, I'm going to read it out because I'd say the guys would rather die than have to, but it says, he once told filmmaker Margot McCuig, a documentary filmmaker and novelist, he said to her, come to my penthouse and I will show you my pyramid. Now, his son has defended this, saying, oh, my father was an old school chauvinist. Nothing worse than that. But like, you can't play the line of, oh, it was a different time. I mean, this is constant. This is, there's allegations of rape. There are just sexual misconduct absolutely everywhere. Young children involved. There's one story. The survivor told me that the child came into her room one night and told her that she didn't want to sleep in her room anymore as she didn't like Al-Fayed getting into her bed. Like, this is really harrowing reading, and it's all just coming out. It just seems to be everywhere. And I'm actually a little bit staggered that it's taken this long when there have been so many other stories and so many other, we've just, you know, chatted about some of the litany of lists of men who have been offenders that have all come to light in the last number of years. But that this is only coming out now, and that there seems to be so much of it going back such a long time is really frightening.
Well, this is the thing, Paul, that you probably have an insight into, given that your long time as a crime journalist. I assume the reason that it is all coming out now is you are much less suable by a dead person. Absolutely. And therefore it's a lot easier to report now than it was a year ago.
But Jimmy Savile was hiding in plain view. Mm. Like, he was like he wasn't just standing in plain view. He was like a huge building standing in the middle of an empty field, and nothing was done about him. But this is one of the things that happened in this case from some of the stuff I read today, is that, you know, Fayed was very, very powerful. And of course, it's all about power and money, all of this. But he had good lawyers. And when these allegations came up before they died, but it was one of the really sort of disturbing things about this monster. And, you know, you look at him now and say, Jesus, doesn't he look the part? Is that people were terrified of him. The reporter who did the programme for BBC was being interviewed, I think, on News Talk here during the week, and he was talking about the fact that he worked there for a while as a kid, and everybody was absolutely in awe and terror of this man. So you had this big predatory monster, a bit like Weinstein, you know, or all of them, you know, so many of them, Bill Cosby, these guys were just walking around doing whatever they wanted. And this the power differential through money and through fame, it's
and
actually
the power
terrifying.
In some instance, through employment, because there's instances of women talking about working in Harrods and being sent for personal medical exams where the medical records went back to Fayed before they went to them. I mean,
that program was recently, you know, the guy who ran Fox News, I can't think of his name now because my brain doesn't
Roger
work.
Ailes.
Roger Ailes. Like what he was up to. Another predatory monster. And they were absolutely everywhere. But you think about it, we're living in 2024 now. What was it like for women in 84, 94? Up to a few years ago, clearly, under this monster. When you were going into a job, I always find that startling when I think about it as a man. It never bothered me, you know, in my own personal life or any other. But to be in a position where you feel that you have to allow this creep to maul you because you want to have your job, it's an appalling. Like, the bastard should be taken and put away. They should all be put behind bars and given life, not 5, 10, 50. It's an appalling thing to do. It really is. And I have a daughter, and any of us have kids. You think, what would happen? What would you do if you realised that happened to your child? You'd kill the bastard. Pardon my language, but it's really infuriating when you think of it.
It'll be interesting to see what Harrods does, because Harrods has been sympathetic and empathetic in print, but has also been drawing a clear line of ownership distinction between the current owners and the previous owners, which would suggest that they are hedging their bets to some extent.
But that's an issue I had with Fulham. I mean, they still took his money. And that's the bit I have a real problem with. They allowed him to buy their football club, their women's club. They went professional and they used his money. So it's like, at what point in time do management compromise their own ethics and values?
But of course, what they will say is what information they did say
they knew, because they told him to avoid him. He likes young blondes. So if they knew,
but Scott, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, it's having, you know, again, lived through the Al-Fayed period. Here's an Egyptian who had become part of the English establishment, the football club, Harrods, that iconic of what it means to be in London. His whole connections with royals, you know, the royalty, of course, Dodi, and you know, his son dying in the crash with Princess Di. And when you get that type of position in the English elite, it carries a bit of protection. Now, here's my question is, where does this go next? Now, what is interesting is that twice Al-Fayed was considered for prosecution by the Crown Prosecution Service. In 2009, when the head was Keir Starmer, who is now Prime Minister, and in 2015. Now, they said it looks like insufficient evidence. And you can understand it is very hard to prosecute sexual abuse cases. But still, I think there'll have to be a little bit more of a reckoning as to why this went through this. And I think that reckoning is also going to have to be, whether it be Fulham, whether it be Harrods, whether it be boardrooms everywhere, what are you doing now to ensure a level of accountability where women can be heard, or men if they are abused, because that happens as well, where this won't be swept under the carpet? This is going to be an ongoing story beyond Al-Fayed.
And not just abused, but also exploited. Because going to your point, John, about the Roger Ailes, there was a line quoted by one of the female anchors in Fox News that Roger Ailes said to her, "I didn't spend thousands of dollars putting glass tables in these studios so you could wear trousers."
That's right, Jim.
And you think that level of personal exploitation to be the norm. Anyway, let us set that to one side. There are much other to talk about. 53106 at a cost of 30 cents if you want, or 087-1400-106. Joan, want to get your view on this, given that you are with Siemens and know all of these high-tech things. Working from home.
Love it.
Fueled by so many of the tech giants. And now, as God giveth, he taketh away. Amazon has said everybody is back 5 days a week. And an awful lot of the analysis says that's the canary in the coal mine, lads. Brace yourselves. We're all going back to work 5 days a week.
No.
Moving on.
No, honestly, I don't think so. I think there is a slight reference to it in this story that suggests that it's just that it's kind of a way of them addressing a need to cut back on too much managers, and it's going to force a lot of people to want to quit. And if that's how they want to solve the problem, maybe that's their way of doing it. I don't see it. Like, I was working from home pre-COVID. And a number of my colleagues in Ireland, in Siemens, were working from home pre-COVID. We all know where the office is. We do go in when we are required to go there. But I don't believe, and I said this to Paul, I don't believe in the magic fairy fort of innovation that is the water cooler. My eye, that is not where innovation happens. You know, we actually have processes for that. I think it's different. And we did talk about, Paul, in the newsroom.
In the media, it's different.
Yeah, in the media, it's different. You're sharing stories.
Well, we've got
real work to do.
I haven't worked in an office for over 10 years now. The only in between, the nearest thing to a routine in my life is coming in here every morning at 4 o'clock, and I still have PTSD from. But when journalists are sitting around gossiping and talking nonsense in pubs and newsrooms, I saw some of the best ideas we ever had coming up. Just guys standing beside the water cooler. Now people say, what's a water cooler? But, you know, water cooler moments. And like, just people talking and say, well, I know such a thing. And you don't, you've lost that organic sort of communications network when you're working remotely because you don't have discussions. It's the gossiping
and this is being said by more companies, including some of your big tech peers.
I'm going to say this. So the World Economic Forum has recognized that creativity is a number one skill in the world required right now for our futures. And one of the things, and you mentioned that I was an artist, and one of the things that is part of that artist mindset is needing to ebb to flow. And I need time away. We have all talked about diversity. It is the most current thing that we talk about in workplaces and what we need. And there are diversity of skills and styles. And some roles, more creative innovation roles, require a different kind of work pattern. And personally speaking, that requires me not being sitting in a grey office staring.
We're not going to make you personally go back 5 days a week.
As to the broader trend,
why is Jeff Bezos telling all these people to do this if he doesn't think it's going to make him more money? Because Jeff doesn't tend to do things that don't make him more money.
Okay, he's doing things because it's going to make him more money. But I don't, and it said it's the equivalent, going back to work is the equivalent of an 8% pay cut going back into the office for work, not going back to work because we're all working very hard at home. But it's because, and it will drive quit rates. Right. So this is my point. It's that this is a really, really neat measure by a large corporation to say we're going to do 5 days a week. And if you don't like it, you know now, where the door is.
Scott, can I put a thesis to you based on this? This thing of it driving quit rates. Is there anything to be said for a belief that whatever about the merits of working from home, that for middle to senior managers, it irks them because they can't look at people and see what they're at, nor can they talk to them. And that they're all just waiting in the long grass for a bit of a recession to say, now that it's a seller's market, in you come.
I'm not going to put myself in the crosshairs of every middle to senior executive out there. I think I was actually doing some work with alongside the head of a leading investment firm in Dublin last week. And it was an in-person event. You know, we were all gathered and went out to Dremoland out near County Clare. And that was great. That's lovely. You know, as a blow-in, that's great. That's why you want to, you know, you get the, and there's an example where you get everybody there and so on. But as he's saying out there, he's explaining to me that their culture of how they worked, in part because of COVID, but ongoing, has completely changed. That there are those moments where you do need to be in the office. You need to exchange ideas and so on. But he says also there are times when we want people to be able to have their space at homes. And he says for two reasons. So his first is, sometimes that mental space when you're on and your own is needed, and they find they're sharper there. But secondly, especially in an area like Dublin, which has its issues with transport, with infrastructure, that the amount of cost to a lot of firms from demanding that people come into the office, it outweighs the benefits. So I think the idea is that the hybrid environment is where we're going to be. And Jeff Bezos, who I don't want to upset because, you know, he owns the Washington Post as well, you know, he's got his take on this and he's got his headlines. But I think a lot of firms will be on a different
area. One of the things they did reference here is that Amazon is really a retailer rather than a technology company. And I thought that was a bit of a blunt thing because Amazon Web Services is not a retailer. It is a very, very different business. But I think it's an interesting point about productivity because everybody will tell you that it is such a blanket measure, such a blunt instrument to say, oh, you know, you'll be more productive if you're all in the office. Well, actually, for a load of people, they will be. That's an average. A lot of people will be less productive.
Hard to find good data on either side.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at poor Paul. I mean, he's had to get up really early this morning.
The anecdotal experience of Paul is not enough to extrapolate.
Definitely not
a good example.
And it's like, you know, he's less productive now than he is on a Tuesday morning, arguably at 12.
It's true, it'll take him all day to recover.
Peak performance.
There's a lot of very enthusiastic agreement with you. Let me give you some of the opposition because it's more crack to start with. The biggest threat to foreign direct investment in Ireland is working from home.
It's a lack of housing is what it is. It's not working from home.
And the majority, the consensus are represented by, I fully agree with Joan. I'm the head of HR for a large financial company. Our employees only have to come to the office once a week. This is our point of difference as an employer, and we're getting so much top talent as a result. Productivity is up, errors down. Some jobs or industries, it may not work, but for employee satisfaction and attracting and retaining the best, it is the best point of difference.
And that is referenced in here as well, because it says, actually, when you get those people who are going to leave their job because they have to do 5 days a week in the office, the best people will leave because they will have the most employment options elsewhere. And now suddenly it becomes about the employee and where they are choosing to work. And you will get companies who are offering the most flexibility, will get the best people. And the best people are productive, whether they're at home or whether they're on top of the roof.
That voice is Joan Mulvihill, who is digitalisation lead at Siemens, also an artist. Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute, is with us as well, as is Paul Williams, crime journalist with the Irish Independent on News Talk. Let us stay with the US and, Scott, of course, the country of your birth and US politics. And we saw the fairly extraordinary thing happen where a US presidential candidate and vice presidential candidate expressed disappointment at the Fed cutting interest rates.
It's not unusual when you're talking about Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, if you want to talk about it. I mean, the serious point here is that that cut of 0.5% by the Fed, which we anticipated and which will probably continue into early 2025, it's a marker of the fact that inflation in the United States is now very much under control. It's now under 3%. Compared to 11% in the post-COVID shock.
And the U.S. middle class consumes credit like almost no other cohort, and the U.S. middle class is where the Democrats are targeting.
Absolutely right. And what you have here is, just to put it into wide frame, because it cuts across a couple of other stories we may discuss, is the politics of reality versus the politics of fear. Now, Trump and Vance are going to play on the politics of fear when Trump is coherent, which is, look, the country is ravaged by inflation. It's economically a basket case. You know, immigrants are streaming across our borders. On the economic front, the reality of that is that, in fact, inflation has come down sharply. It's come down from 9% on average in 2022 to below 3 now. GDP is up 5% year on year. A lot of the Biden administration's legislative achievements, infrastructure, the green economy, are coming through. But the question is which way the U.S. media goes, and indeed even the Irish media, because there's a misleading story today, a very misleading story today, I fear, in the Sunday Times. And that is, do they go with the headlines of fear, which are unsourced, but which a lot of people will think, yeah, that's me, which benefits Trump? Or do they actually go with the reality of this is, which is that America has gone, like many countries, has gone through a tough time with supply chain, energy prices, et cetera. But no, this has been handled very competently. And the person who was vice president of the Biden administration can take the country on an upward path.
Scott, is that a rhetorical question? Because in the context where the one political candidate is doubling down on the suggestion that Haitian immigrants are stealing people's pets and eating them, I would have thought getting people to focus on the reality of inflation rates and Fed actions is a long way away from what's realistically possible.
Well, this is the double-edged thing about Trump and Vance, which is Trump has succeeded in the past, 2016, by not sticking and talking about issues, by running an issues-free campaign, and by making absolute ludicrous claims. His advisors told him this year, stick to the economy, stick to immigration, even if you're putting out misinformation, because that's where you're going to win. And they're tearing their hair out because he doesn't do that. He didn't do it, remember, before the immigrants eating our pets story, when he said Kamala Harris isn't really black. He didn't really do it when he called her Laughing Kamala, which alienated a lot of undecided women voters. And the Democrats are begging the Republicans, or at least Trump, don't talk about the issues. Don't talk about the economy and immigration. Say crazy stuff and we'll capitalize on it.
Joan, you want to come in?
Oh, really? I do. I so do. I think it's a really interesting thing that you put up reality versus fear. Yeah. And I think I started thinking about what you were, those examples you gave, and it's about how people consume media, it would appear, in terms of US politics and how people are reactionary. And the amount of clickbaiting that you can do with fear is so much easier than reality. You're never going to have a great clickbait, you know, headline on economics. Sexy as it is to like three people in the world, you know, it's really not going to float the boat of all those voters in America who are just clicking and they're getting all their media online. And that's where they're consuming it really, really quickly. They're not getting into the depth of an awful lot of stories. You can tell them people reality all day long. And it's not going to get their
now,
attention
hang on for a minute.
As much as some of the nonsense.
If I am a Trump voter, I know whether I read it through the tea leaves of the blatant bigotry or whether I actually read any of the policy platforms. I know if I'm rich, I'm likely to get more tax cuts out of Trump than I am if Biden or if Harris gets elected. I know that he is going to want to repeal the Green Deal, which means anything like forcing me to sell my pickup truck so I have to buy an EV is going to be less likely to happen. I know he's going to deregulate like mad, which is probably what I want most of all. And I know that he is going to be anti-immigrant, which I may well be. They're all real things, even if they're
being
presented through madness
in a crazy way. Yeah, I think there's some of that, and I think for the rational voter who's going to really think about it, that will some of that stuff will resonate. But I think there's an awful lot of irrationality. Like Scott, you mentioned something about trauma, and when people are traumatized, they are going through trauma that has been unresolved. Their ability to absorb real facts, to actually look at situations in a non-panic mode, to make rational decisions is compromised. And I think there is a massive compromise of rationality going on in the US.
Well, this is Scott's theory as voiced during the break. Yeah. So rather than talking about it in the absence of the theory, maybe you might give us it, Scott.
Yeah, I'd be interested what you all think about this. And, you know, even though I've lived outside the US since the 80s, family are still there, friends are still there. Part of your heart is still always there. And ever since 9/11, you've had a country which has almost been in a bit of trauma about who America is, because we're the country that likes to shout at football matches, we're number one, USA. And you had 9/11, you had the disaster in Iraq, the disaster in Afghanistan, you had the Great Recession, where you get a lot of current Trump voters who feel like they've never bounced back from that. And then you get Trump exploiting that whole anger and frustration and trauma by being, he's the equivalent of the 19th century snake oil salesman. You're angry. You're frustrated. I'm going to sell you the snake oil, going to make it all better. Now, the snake oil isn't going to work, but when it doesn't work, you still double down with this guy, especially when he says, if you don't follow me, there's bad guys right out there on the frontier. They're going to come after you. It won't work with some American voters. It won't work, but it does work with his base. The real question to watch this election is two things. One is, in between those that buy the snake oil, those that don't, who are the undecided voters going to break for?
And there's a few of them, though, isn't there?
No, there's more than the media talks about. And I'm tired about people talking about and had this basically, oh, it's only low information voters who won't go out there. Because voters will have more than one issue on their plate. Mm. So if they're worried about the economy, but they're also worried about women's rights, especially the current reproductive rights, which is the priority here? If they're worried about immigration, but they're also worried about the threat to democracy, which do they go for? So it's the undecided voters who have that list of that they have out there. And then the second thing, which is part of Irish politics as well as U.S. politics, you get your people out on election day. You get them to the polls. Who's got
the
better
in the swing states is hugely important. I mean, if you look at the margins in Georgia and North Carolina in the last election, tens of thousands will make the difference.
It will. And just
Taylor Swift.
Yeah, and do not underestimate the importance, again, in an America of spectacle, where Taylor, a childless cat lady, makes a difference. My projection is you got seven swing states. We can talk about them at a later point. But the reason why this election is now a toss-up and the Democrats have the advantage is that the Democrats had almost no route to victory when Biden was still in. Now they've got multiple routes. They can either win those key three states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, or they can win two of them, plus a couple of the states like Georgia and Arizona that swung to the Democrats in 2020.
Is he deluded, Paul? What do you think? Is he optimistic beyond reality?
No, I was just about to ask that question because this is, as you know, Ireland is the 51st United States, yeah, and we are a Democratic state. And if we were part of the United States, the Democrats wouldn't even have to come and canvass.
53106, 087-1400-106 if you have a differing view.
But do you think, can I ask this, Scott, because you're the expert on this, do you, what, who do you give Who are you putting your money on for president of the United
States? I don't want to put my money anywhere. Now, if anybody wants to hand me their money, I'll take it from them. Because, like I said,
Paddy Power's listening.
If I thought it was something beyond a toss-up election, I wouldn't be joining you good folks right now. I'd be at the bookies. All right. So let me just lay out the parameters where we are. It's going to be a close election. As Anton said, you're talking about tens of thousands of votes that will decide it. But right now, I would rather be either Harris than Trump for this reason. Less than 10% of voters say they want to know more about Trump, about only 9%. About 30% of voters want to know more about Harris. She's got more of a ceiling to work with, but that comes back to, can the Democrats continue to run a, when they go low, we go high campaign, as opposed to Trump's idea of carnage and devastation? Can they bring the positive back into American politics?
It will be interesting to watch, because if it is fraught now, it will only get more fraught as the weeks go on. We were speaking earlier about productivity and working from home and Amazon's decision to bring everybody back into the office. And Joan was making a very compelling treatise as to why this was not going to happen. Hi, Anton. I don't care about productivity. Working from the office means I have commuting issues and childcare issues that working from home doesn't give me. They help to hide the imbalance the government doesn't feel a need to address. How am I supposed to get my kids into school at 9 a.m. and myself into work in the office at the same time? And then another from the other view, reworking from home. Younger generations don't have a clue how the working world works and could do with being in the office more.
I do think in my earlier stages of my career, I loved going to the office, but I'm in a different stage of life now. And I think that is the thing. We talked about diversity. It's not for all the people all the time. I still go in. We have great days in the office. And actually, Siemens make a huge effort to make sure that we are all in the office together, that we do.
There's something to do while you're there.
It's a real purposeful.
Come here, I mentioned you were digitalization lead at Siemens and artist. You have an exhibition?
I am in an exhibition in Mayfair in London next month on art in the age of AI. So we were talking a bit about Elon Musk. And actually, I have a painting called Projectile Dysfunction, is what it's called, in honour of Elon.
Well, if we're in Mayfair, we will drop by. Joan, thank you very much. Joan Mulvihill, Digitalisation Lead at Siemens and Artist. Likewise, big thank you to Paul Williams, crime journalist with the Irish Independent, and Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute in University College Dublin.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.